Okay, so I just want to give one more reminder that Eric Lango is going to be coming on Monday to talk about game engine architecture. And that is not in this classroom. It's in the David Rittenhouse lab, which is right across 33rd Street. So it's just right across the street from here, A4. I'll put a sign up on this door so that in case you do come that you know to go over there. And please come. I think it's going to be a great talk. I mean, Eric knows an awful lot about game engine design. He's the editor of the Game Engine Gem series, and he's been working on the C4 engine for a long time now, maybe 10 years. And he's coming all the way from California just to talk to us. So please be there. And then you have another guest lecture today. Sean will be speaking in a few minutes, and I'll introduce him when the time comes. But before he starts telling us about shadows, I want to finish the tail end of the graphics pipeline. It's just two more stages I want to go over. One is the depth test, which I know that you're at least already somewhat familiar with from 460, and then the final stage there is blending. The depth test is something that you'll have to do for your rasterizer because you won't get correct images. You'll get incredibly wrong images without it. In fact, you could turn it off and see what your rasterizer comes out. The blending stage is optional for your rasterizer, but it's probably, well, there's some synchronization there, but it's maybe not low-hanging fruit, but maybe medium difficulty feature if you want to add it as one of your extra features. So I'll just go through maybe five or six slides from our graphics pipeline slide deck, and then this won't finish the slide deck because I still want to map this pipeline to the current hardware. But I won't do that until next Wednesday. We'll finish it then. I just want to get in this part here so you have everything you need for your rasterizer. Okay, so now we're pretty far along in the pipeline. Wow, that doesn't look good, does it? Huh, okay. Well, let's just look at this one for a second. You know, we started off with vertices. We transformed them. We did primitive assembly. We rasterized those primitives. We got fragments for each of the primitives. Then we ran that through a fragment shader to determine a color and depth. And then we went through a couple tests, the scissor test and the stencil test. And so and it's passed all these tests, so this fragment is almost ready to be written to the frame buffer. But we need to resolve visible surfaces. We need to say, well, what fragments are in front of what other fragments from the direction of the viewer. And we do this with the depth test or the Z test, which uses a corresponding depth buffer or Z buffer. Remember, Z and depth are the same thing. It's just different terminology. And the depth buffer is a buffer that is the same size, say, as the color buffer, where, say, if the color buffer was 640 by 480, the depth buffer is also 640 by 480, except instead of storing RGB, it stores depth values, which are scalar between 0 and 1. It's configurable between 0, but it's almost always between 0 and 1. You could change that range. Where if it's something's at the near plane, it's at 0. If it's at the far plane, it's at 1. And this is just a brute force algorithm where it says, if this fragment has a smaller depth value, then it wins the depth test. Although, when this is actually mapped to hardware, this is configurable, and you can make the depth test however you want. You can do, is this fragment in front of the fragment, or is it behind the fragment? Do they equal each other? There's lots of different configuration options. But for most standard uses, you're just going to say, if the fragment depth value is less than the current fragment depth, then it wins the depth test and bring it through. And this allows us to resolve visible surfaces. And you probably had like two full lectures on various techniques to do visible surfaces. And let me show you, here's a screenshot. So here's some terrain rendered. And this is an image from my virtual globe book. And this is out in like California area. Here's some terrain rendered. And then the fragment shader here is just doing some simple shading based on the slope of the terrain, where it's kind of bright, where it's really steep, and dark, where it's flat. And then also the fragment shader is also drawing these contours based on height, the red contours there. So this is the color buffer, and here is the depth value, where you can see the black ones, they're near 0, white ones are near 1, so the black ones are closer to the viewer, and the white ones are farther behind. The depth buffer is really interesting. In fact, I could spend a whole class period on it. I have a whole slide deck on the depth buffer. What I like about it is, right, so it's simple, and everyone understands it, right? And everyone's, I think, has probably seen it before, right? Any questions on, like, how it works? So this, originally, there was a paper, it's like 1975, I want to say, and they had 10 different visible surface algorithms. The deck buffer didn't even have a name, and it was a footnote. And it's just like, this is ridiculously expensive. Those were what? Ridiculously expensive and brute force, they called it. And then later in Ed Catmull's PhD thesis, they did finally name it the death buffer or the Z buffer. And Ed Catmull went on to find Pixar, right? And I've heard of the Catmull run splines too from 462. But now, what was once ridiculously expensive, what was once brute force, is now the standard visible surface algorithm ran on every video card and every real-time application under the sun. And why that happened is really because the hardware changed. In the 70s, memory was really expensive, and you didn't have a lot of it. Now, memory densities went way up, and this mapped really well to hardware. And on top of that, there's all these optimizations that you can put on top of the depth test to make it go really fast. Now, here's one simple example. Back here, I'm showing you the depth test after the fragment shader. Okay, but if the fragment shader doesn't modify the depth value, you can bring the depth test earlier in the pipeline to before the fragment shader, and we call that early Z. And all commodity GPUs do that nowadays. And then we can do so many other tricks with the depth buffer. We can compress it, we can build mipmaps, we can do hierarchical Z. There's a lot of different techniques we can do to make this really fast. And we may or may not talk about them later this semester. We'll see. But I think it's really cool in that it was once considered, just brute force, not, just naive. And now, because of the way hardware has changed, it is the algorithm of choice. So I wonder what other algorithms today in graphics or maybe outside of graphics do we think is naive and brute force, but will be the algorithm as hardware trends change? I'll put that on the exam. There is no exam there. Okay, so the final stage I want to talk about. So it went through the per fragment test. We passed depth tests. Okay, so this fragment is the closest one to the viewer at this part in our scene that we're drawing. The final one I want to talk about is blending. I obviously haven't looked at these slides recently. Blending allows us to take our output from the fragment shader and combine it with the current value in the frame buffer. So, for example, we might just want to take the value, the color in the frame buffer, the color from the fragment shader, and just add them. Or maybe you want to subtract them. Or maybe you want to weight each one and then add or subtract them. Do you guys know what the most common use case for blending is?
Refractions.
Come again?
Refractions.
Refraction? No. Good thinking though. What?
Transparency,
right? So, and this is actually one of, if you're looking at hard problems in real-time rendering today, transparency is one of them. So if we use blending, or in particular alpha blending, we can get an approximation to transparency. It is nothing like what you've done with your path tracers, but it is generally convincing enough that we use for real-time rendering. The simplest way to do blending is additive blending, where you have an alpha value stored. So, your output from your fragment shader isn't just RGB. It can also have an alpha channel. And that can be opacity, where 0 is completely transparent and 1 is completely opaque. So you can store alpha values, either in your texture maps, right? Certainly you can do that. Or you can just store it at the object level or any granularity. And you can use that to determine how opaque a surface is. So then you can just do simple additive blending where you just multiply the output from the fragment shader by its alpha and then add it to whatever's there. The problem with that is it saturates really quick. It goes to white really quick and then you clamp it at 1.0. So no one really uses... Okay, we don't use additive blending often. You can get away with it in some cases, but generally not. So instead we use more general alpha blending, which the equation I show right down here, where you use the source alpha value coming out of the fragment shader, and then you multiply that by the color coming out of the fragment shader. But then you also take 1 minus the source alpha for the destination value. And this is much more convincing. The problem with this is due to the minus, this depends on the order that you draw your geometry. Now, we're not requiring it in your rasterizer, as far as I remember, but OpenGL will guarantee that the triangles, the order that you send your triangles down the pipeline is the order that they appear to be rasterized. It may do other things under the hood to exploit parallelism, which means that if I draw five triangles, it will go triangle one would finish, triangle two would finish, triangle three would finish. It would appear to be that way. So in order to get convincing blending, we need to draw these such that the objects are sorted back to front from the viewer's perspective. The problem with doing that is that anytime the viewer moves, you have to resort. And sorting can be really slow when you would sort on the CPU. And if you have a lot of triangles, it's horrendous. It's really bad. And you render these after you render all your opaque objects. You render your opaque objects, then you render your translucent guys. And your translucent guys typically won't write depth either. They'll read depth, but not write depth. So there's actually quite a bit to it. And this is like, I won't say it's a big problem in real-time rendering today. And there's techniques that I hope to explore called order-independent translucency, where we can get around doing the sorting on the CPU, where instead we'll keep a linked list or an array behind each pixel, and then we'll do the sorting at the tail end on the GPU. And actually, I have that as an optional optional feature for your rasterizer. It'd be very awesome. I'd be thrilled for you to do that. So you should totally do that, and you get a lot of press too, because order-independent translucency is a hot topic. And in fact, the cover of my OpenGL Insights book is based on the chapter in that has order-independent translucency. Okay, what questions do you have about the blending stage? I mean, the blending stage is really, from ignoring the use case for it, the blending stage is really like, I have my color coming out of the fragment shader, and I have my colors already in the frame buffer. How do I combine them? You know what I mean? Do I add them? Do I scale each one and then add or subtract? Or do I just overwrite the frame buffer value with the one coming out of the fragment shader? Sound good? Yep.
So when you change the view, do you also have to re-rasterize?
Do I have to do what?
Rasterization again.
Right. So anytime the viewer moves, you re-render the entire scene. You re-render everything. Right? So because everything changed. The visibility changed. The orient from the respect of the lights, the positions changed. Like everything needs to be redone. But there's a lot of work that we do in temporal coherence where, for example, say you're doing view frustum calling, and if an object is outside of the view frustum on the right-hand side, one frame, on the next frame, chances are it's going to be outside the view frustum on the right-hand side again. So we do lots of things to take advantage of temporal coherence. But the scene is still rasterized over again.
Right. Does even primitive assembly have to be done again?
Right. The whole pipeline is done over again. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but the GPUs are fast. Hopefully you're convinced of that by this point. Other questions? Okay. I think that's pretty much it for the rasterizer. So then after the blending state, now we write to the frame buffer. We write our color. And then remember, we have another, not just the color buffer, but we have the depth buffer too. So you have to update the depth buffer too, so that future triangles or future fragments are able to read from the depth. And that's going to require some synchronization too, like when you implement it in your rasterizer. So one option is to keep your depth buffer in global memory and use atomics. If you want to do some shared memory stuff and maybe tile up the depth buffer, I mean, that would be beautiful. You guys should just go crazy. Don't let me hold you back. You know, don't let your other courses hold you back either. Spend as much time as you want on the rasterizer. Okay, so that's it for the mile wide or big overview for the pipeline. We will map it to the current hardware, and I'll show you kind of how the hardware has evolved. And then we'll go into more specifics, like how do we program this thing with OpenGL, which is going to be easy once you've done your rasterizer. And then just more fine-grained things, like, well, what does this pipeline look in more recent hardware? Which we heard, there's all these other shader stages that I didn't mention. You know, what do they look like? So it'll be some really cool stuff coming up in the course. Okay, so any final questions on the graphics pipeline? Cool. So with that, I'm going to let Sean come up and talk about shadows. You want me to bring your slides up, Sean?
Okay.
Yeah, I have them here.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so this is Sean Lilly, who's a DMD senior, and he took this class last semester, and he did his final project was in order-independent translucency. which was really good. And then he went to AMD for the summer and worked actually with the co-editor of OpenGL Insights that I worked with. And he worked on shadows all summer. In particular, he looked at using an extension called Sparse Textures, which are virtual memory meets OpenGL textures, so really good textures for doing shadowing techniques. And then this semester, Sean is doing some work with voxel rendering, sparse voxel octrees, that he'll actually present a week from now again in this class. Him and his brother Ian, who worked with me last summer, and another student, Knopp, who are all DMD students that took this class last semester. So Sean, I'm not afraid to admit that he knows more about shadows than I know, so therefore he is giving this lecture instead of me. And one thing that I just wanted to get, I want you guys to think about is, you've looked at doing shadows with ray tracing, right? It's pretty easy. Then you looked at doing soft shadows with photon mapping, that was pretty easy. Wait till you see what we go through in real-time rendering to fake shadows. It's actually a really big topic. So Sean, it's all yours.
Yeah, so I'm talking about shadows for real-time rendering. Very big topic. So, yeah, you guys did a ray tracer. Basically, to do hard shadows in a ray tracer, you send a ray from the eye, it hits a surface, and then it sees if it's occluded by anything before it reaches the light. So in this case, when it hits the floor, it sends a shadow ray to the light, but it's obstructed by the sphere, and so it's in shadow. And soft shadows are a little different. It's where we actually treat lights as physical volumes in space. So it's more like a cone than a ray. And it also creates these soft shadows. So we have the penumbra, which is where the cone is partially shadowed. Or it's partially shadowed. The light is a little bit visible to the area. And then the umbra, which is completely shadowed. So in terms of real-time rendering, we have two main techniques to do shadows: shadow volumes and shadow maps. Shadow volumes are represented by actual geometry. They're a bunch of triangles that sort of represent shadow regions in space. And the pros are that they produce accurate hard shadows. The cons are that it's usually pretty slow and rasterization heavy. And then shadow maps are, they, instead of working in world space, they work in image space. And they use the depth buffer, which you guys just learned about, to do comparison tests to see if a pixel is in shadow or not. And the pros, it's very fast, and it has good support for soft shadows. But the cons are that it's high memory usage because you have to use textures. And the really big con is aliasing. It's a huge problem, and there's many techniques to try to fix it. So first I'll talk about shadow volumes. These were invented in 1977, and they were popularized by Doom 3 in 2005. And now they aren't really used.
Yeah, Sean, can you give us a feel? I mean, what do you think is the most recent game that is using shadow volumes?
I don't know. I just know that Doom 3 did it well, and some people copied it.
Doom 3 did it, and then there's a might be Far Cry, but there's another game that also did shadow volumes. The Larrabee paper from Cigarette analyzed, and they showed that a lot of the bottleneck was actually in rasterization because it had so many triangles from the from the shadow volume geometry. But yeah, I was just curious if you could give more recent uses.
Yeah, so the basic approach is for each triangle in the scene, project its edges to infinity along the direction of the light. So if you see in the left image, the quad face, its edges are extending along the light direction and creates this pyramid shape. And you can see that any objects that lie inside this pyramid are shadowed. From the right picture, you see that circle that's in the pyramid is shadowed. The one that's outside is not shadowed. So in order to do this, you have to first do a depth prepass. And this just guarantees that you aren't rasterizing any shadow volumes that you don't need to.
So tell us what you mean when you say depth prepass.
Okay, so depth prepass is just, you render the entire scene into the depth buffer. You disable the color buffer. You're simply getting an idea of what the world is like, which fragments are closest to the camera. You are ignoring all the fragments that are behind. It's essentially an optimization step. And so after you've done the depth prepass, you render the shadow volumes, because these are triangles you can actually render in rasterize. So as you rasterize them, you see if the triangle is front-facing, then you increment the stencil buffer. If it's back-facing, you decrement the stencil buffer. And if the value of the stencil buffer at a particular pixel is 0, then that pixel is not in shadow. So looking at this picture here, you can see, it's a little hard to see because I scanned it from a book, but if you see it coming from the eye, you see a plus where it hits the first shadow volume because it's a front face, and then it hits another plus, which is the second shadow volume. And then after it leaves the first shadow volume, it subtracts, and then the second shadow volume subtracts again.
Sean, I'd like to chime in for one or something completely unrelated, which is if you ever need to use an image from a book, you should contact the authors, and this goes for everyone, and ask them if they're willing to put their book images, the images from their book online. Because I do that for my Virtual Globe book, and I'm working on doing that for OpenGL Insights.
Yeah.
And it's good for our field in order to have those images available. And it's also good for the book author and publisher because they get the credit. You know what I mean? So don't be shy. I know some of those authors too. So.
Yeah, they have some of their images online. It's just, I didn't even think about contacting them.
Then, you know, for this, it might be, I totally understand why you did this, but that's just a general thought.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want to ask is this stencil buffer trickery that he's doing here, increment, decrement, depending on what, if it's front facing or back facing, this is approximating shooting a ray through the volume, or it's acting as a ray through the volume. Right? Do you guys see that? No? Sean, you
want to talk? So you're kind of doing an intersection test of two rays.
Essentially, except, yeah, it's an intersection test in the form of rasterization. Yeah, and as you can see, later when you render the scene, the cylinder that's in the two shadow maps, the stencil buffer would read 2 because it's in, the stencil buffer was incremented whenever you went through a shadow map or a shadow volume. And the cube on the right is 0 because you went through both shadow volumes and left both shadow volumes. And so the value is 0. Yeah, and so that brings me just to the last thing, which is render the scene again. This time, enable the color buffer. Use the stencil buffer as a mask. If the stencil buffer value is greater than 0, then you know that fragment must be in shadow. And if the stencil buffer value is 0, just do your diffuse and specular lighting like usual. So there are some improvements. One of the major problems when this algorithm was first released was that it doesn't account for when the camera originates in the shadow volume. So if I go back, if the eye were inside one of those shadow volumes, the stencil buffer would, if there were an object in the first shadow volume, it would have a value of 0, because technically it has not passed any triangles in the shadow volume. So it would say that object is 0, but really it's not. It's in a shadow volume. So we use what is known as Z-fail, or Carmack's reverse. That was sort of invented by John Carmack for Doom 3. Essentially, it does the same operation of shooting a ray through the volumes, except it does it from, not from the eye, but from a point that's opposite direction, infinitely far away. Essentially what happens is it reverses all the operations. Instead of when it passes the depth test, it needs to fail the depth test. And instead of decrementing the stencil value, if it's back facing, you increment. And instead of incrementing, when it's front facing, you decrement. Another improvement to the shadow volume technique is to use the geometry shader, which was not around when Doom 3 came out. What you can do is you can create your shadow volumes on the geometry shader by having each triangle emit primitives for just the front cap, the sides, and the bottom cap. And geometry shaders can just make primitives.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet, but a geometry shader stage is after primitive assembly, and it will allow you to take one primitive and destroy it or create multiple primitives from it. And this is useful because creating a shadow volume kind of sucks. Like, as the object moves or as the light moves, you need to create a new shadow volume. You sit on the CPU and create that geometry. It can be really CPU intensive.
So yeah, use the geometry shader. We have it now, so might as well use it. Some other improvements are you can use simplified meshes, especially now we have tons of triangles in each mesh. But to create the shadow volumes, you don't need the same detail. You can use simplified meshes. And then finally, it's good to have a good occlusion culling algorithm so that you limit the number of triangles that are actually processed to create these shadow volumes. All right, so that's shadow volumes. They're not really used much anymore, but it's good to know about. It's a different way of thinking about it. And now I'll talk about shadow maps, which are the dominant technique in today's video games. It was invented actually 1 year after shadow volumes, interestingly. So the basic approach is, first, you render the scene from the light's point of view. This is like treating the light as a camera. You can sort of see on the left image. Oh, yeah, it's a little hard to see, but if you can imagine the light in the top left corner, it creates the frustum. And then on the right is the shadow map. What you're doing is you're rendering from the light's point of view to a depth texture. And that's what results. And you saw pictures of depth textures just 20 minutes ago. So now you have your shadow map. It's in a texture. And now you can render the scene from the camera's point of view. So what you do is, for each vertex that's processed, you have to transform it to light space. It's pretty much as simple as sending a matrix to your shader program and using that matrix, do the transformation, and now it's in light space. And then you just compare depths. So if you see the shadows on the left image, if you imagine like this is the camera's view looking at the scene like this, the fragment that's behind one of those columns checks in the shadow map if something is in front of it, essentially. And it will check in the shadow map and see that the shadow map has a lesser depth. And then it'll know that it's shadowed. So there's a bunch of different light types when doing shadow mapping. You have your directional light, which is like a sun, which you can use orthographic projection on. You can have a spotlight, which is a perspective projection. And then point lights, which are like spotlights, except you actually need an omnidirectional shadow map. Because point lights can cast shadows on the top wall, the bottom wall, and the sides. Essentially, to do this, you need to have 6 light frustums and render to a cube map. And you can do this in the geometry shader as well. And shadow mapping is pretty expensive. You have to render all the geometry from the light's point of view and then render them normally. So usually, only one light source casts shadows in a standard video game. Like, that's why you usually only see shadows from one direction in video games. And there's a lot of shadow mapping problems. Aliasing is a huge issue with shadow maps. So first, projective aliasing, then perspective aliasing, then texture resolution limits. And I want to talk about all these. So the first is projective aliasing. This occurs when the slope of the geometry is parallel or nearly parallel to the light direction. So I'm actually just going to skip quickly to the next slide. Here you can see in that the red circle area, the shadow map value is the green, is that green line. And when you, So you can see right above, these fragments up here are going to say they're lit because their depth is less than the depth of the green line. But these fragments down here are going to think they're shadowed because they're below the green line. Essentially, what happens is you have this artifact called Z-fighting, which is where along a surface, it doesn't... Because of these aliasing issues and the precision of the shadow map, it sort of flip-flops between it. Sometimes it's above, sometimes it's below, when really it should all be above. This is extremely bad with a vertical, like when the light's pointing straight down and the shapes the walls are pointing straight up. You can see that in the right picture. It's very aliased. And even just other things like depth, buffer, precision, the resolution of the shadow map, and just float comparisons can cause Z fighting in the left image. So one solution is to apply a depth bias. What this does is during the light pass, it just pushes the depth slightly deeper. So now the depth comparison test will succeed in the best case. If you look at sort of the top part of the circle, it will now succeed because the value in the light map has been artificially shifted downwards, and now it will always pass because of that bias. But it still produces problems in the worst case, like the green arrow is pointing to. There's still that flip-flopping of, oh, right here I'm above, right here I'm below, and you still get that, those Z-fighting artifacts. Oops. Yeah, here you can see a better picture. The elephant has all this Z-fighting on its surface. And even if you add too much depth bias, you have this other problem called light leaking, which is when you basically remove the shadow from the actual object because you biased the shadow too far away. And so the best way to do the depth bias is actually try to use the slope of the geometry. So if you see, the top of the circle is not biased very much because its tangent is pretty much... it's aligned well with the light. And then you want to bias the other areas more. You bias it based on the slope. So one way to do this is use screen space derivatives, which are calculated by hardware. Probably the most common way to do this is use the OpenGL command GL polygon offset, which uses these screen space derivatives to automatically calculate the bias for you. It takes two parameters, a constant bias, and then the slope scaling bias. But it means you still have to tweak parameters. And another way is just use NGLSL, dfdx and dfdy, to convert neighboring screen space pixels and sort of understand them as light slopes. This is more involved. And other improvements that we can make are increase the precision of the depth buffer from 16 bits to 24 to 32. We could also fit the near and far plane of the light frustum to fit the scene better, so we get more out of our shadow map, and there's not empty space.
Yeah, so I should mention here, the depth, today I just said depth is between 0 and 1, typically, and I didn't say anything more about it. On hardware today, it's usually stored on desktop hardware, it's usually 24-bit fixed point precision. On a lot of the mobile stuff, it's only 16-bit. So on... not fairly recent, but you know, it's maybe been 6 years or so. Now we have the depth component 32F, which is what you might have thought when I first said depth out is where that is 32-bit IEEE floating point. And it's funny, you know, Sean talks about all these precision problems we run into. And we run into these not only with shadow mapping, but just vanilla depth buffer rendering, period, if you have a really big scene that you need to draw on the close near plane and far plane. And I have an entire chapter in my virtual globe book is dedicated to dealing with these problems. And it's one difference. Like it's one reason why I wish I worked on video games, because most video games, at least from not from the shadow point of view, but from the general world point of view, they can control their near and far planes such that they don't run into a lot of these artifacts. And a lot of the globe rendering is something I do. You can't, because you might be really close on like a satellite, but then you need to see the sun out in the distance.
Yeah. Yeah, some games have difficult issues with this, like Just Cause. I don't know if anyone's heard of it, but it's a huge world. And
yeah, they had a chapter on it in GPU Pro 1 or 2 on how they dealt with precision.
Yeah, so that's one way to help fit the near and far plane. Also, if we can increase the shadow map resolution, that would help too. And then a final thing is we could linearize the depth buffer. Essentially, the depth buffer is sort of perspective. Because we often do perspective projections, the arrangement of the depth samples is also perspective-based. essentially that gives more detail to what's close and less detail to what's far. But that's from the light's point of view. And so if the camera is looking at an area that's far away from the light, it's not going to have as much detail due to the non-linear depth buffer. So we can linearize the depth buffer. But you have to mess around with like the vertices and the vertex shader. So another issue is texture resolution. The quality is clearly dependent on the texture resolution. Low-res shadow maps produce blocky results, like on the right, and then high-res shadow maps look better, but they take up a lot more memory. And what if the scene is really large? You can't stretch a single texture across the whole world. Then it would be extremely blocky, and it would look very bad. And then another problem is perspective aliasing. This is where the size of pixels in view space don't match the size of the pixels in the shadow map. So if you look at the right image, that red square is represented by a single texel in the shadow map, and it's simply not enough detail. The blue square that's right below the screw is also represented by a single texel in the shadow map, but because it's further away, it provides enough detail for us. And we want to fix both these problems. We want to fix perspective aliasing. We need more detail near the eye and less detail away from the eye. And we also want to handle texture resolution limits. We want to maintain constant texture resolution independent of the scene size. And we also want to center the shadow map around the eye. Also, the shadow map should not cover areas that are out of view.
Sure, I'm going to sidetrack you for a second. So, you know, you showed us shadow volumes that we understand they're not really used that much anymore because they're expensive to create and have a high rasterization overhead. So they said, hey, look, here's a technique called shadow mapping. It's widely used. The concept is pretty simple, right? But now there's all these different artifacts with it, right? So then, you know, maybe we should ask just like, well, geez, ray tracing was just so simple, these shadows, right?
Yeah.
So fundamentally, in a rasterization pipeline, and maybe this is a question for you or a question for anyone here, why couldn't we just ray trace shadows?
Ray trace shadows?
Yeah, why? So why can't we do that in a rasterization pipeline?
I guess I'll try to answer that. So,
does anyone want to answer it first? Because I assume Sean knows the answer, but okay, go ahead.
Okay, so. With ray tracing, you have to basically perform intersection tests with, well, in brute force approach, you have to do an intersection test with every triangle as part of every model, as part of the whole world. And you can sort of hierarchically subdivide these triangles so that it's a little bit faster, but essentially, when you're doing these intersection tests, it's going to be very slow. And shadow mapping does not involve these intersection tests.
Right. So with rasterization, we can ray trace the, in a traditional rasterization model. Now, you're welcome to build any hybrid. Well, for this project, no. But for your final project, you're welcome to go any kind of hybrid. If you want to do, if you're really interested in writing custom rendering pipelines, you're welcome to do like a hybrid rasterization ray tracing pipeline. It would be really, really cool. But in a traditional rasterization model, you don't have access to the entire scene. You know, Sean said, oh, you need all the models, you need all the triangles to shoot your shadow feelers. Well, in rasterization, the triangles are flying through the pipeline, one at, you know, not one at a time, many at a time, but they're flying through this pipeline. Whereas in ray tracing, you know the entire scene as you're shading. In rasterization, you don't. So therefore, we can't shoot a ray through the entire scene because we don't have the entire scene. So the shadow map acts as kind of like a pre-process for what we need to do our shadow feelers, but it's not the entire scene of information.
Yeah, so there are some solutions to handling these perspective aliasing and the texture resolution. And there's two families of techniques. One is warping techniques like perspective shadow maps, light space perspective shadow maps, and logarithmic perspective shadow maps. And then we have the other side, which is frustum partitioning techniques. These are cascade shadow maps, which are also called Z-partitioning, parallel split maps, and also, similarly, sample distribution shadow maps. So first we'll talk about the perspective shadow maps. What happens here is it applies a perspective transformation to the scene prior to rendering to the shadow map. And what this does, it's just a matrix. It replaces your standard view projection matrix. It essentially skews the shadow map so that there's more density near the eye. So in these pictures, they have a red line through the middle. The left is shadow mapping, plane shadow mapping, and the right is using perspective, the perspective to skew. And it's actually the same size shadow map, same number of pixels, but the image on the right has a lot more detail near the eye compared to the one on the left. But this technique had some problems, so some people built on top of it with light space perspective shadow maps. This fixes some of the limitations, such as, or it fixes the limitations by applying the skew matrix to the light's view projection rather than the eye's view projection. Essentially, this fixes the problems of shadow casters that are behind the viewer. It also does not cause lights to change their type, which the previous method did incorrectly. And then it offers just a more stable and better distributed error. And then now we have logarithmic perspective shadow maps, which they have mathematically proven that logarithm is the best, or it leads to the optimal constant error. When you, instead of perspective projection alone, you also use a logarithmic transform, and you get low error. But it requires logarithmic rasterization, which is not supported by current GPU hardware.
So Sean, what is, so that work was done all in software as, you know, as a research work here?
I think they used the fragment shader to do the log, they essentially sent it through the pipeline and then sent it back through the pipeline.
Okay, so this would be killer. If you want to, if you're interested in shadows, you know, you want to take the rasterizer to the next level, you don't want to sleep before now and due date, it'd be really cool to do this. And this work is not that old. What is this paper, 2004 or 2006 or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's that old yet, so please don't be shy. I've had it.
Yeah, it's definitely maybe the next big thing. If GPU hardware changes. And now, in order to better visualize some of these techniques, whoa. Okay. Yeah, this is just plain shadow mapping. On the right is your light map, or your shadow map, and you can see the blockiness pretty clearly. Huh. I think I lost some of my images somehow.
Yeah, I lost some too. I don't know what's going on with that.
I guess that's okay. So basically, you can imagine on the left there would be a nicer looking picture. And the shadow map is skewed now. It's a skewed perspective. It's no longer uniform, it's perspective. And you can see the palm tree on the bottom is now much higher detail than it was here. Here it's just, you can hardly even see the palm tree. But now, because of this perspective shift, the palm tree is now, has a lot of detail in the shadow map because it's close to the eye. And then, wow, this is weird. Okay, this picture was supposed to be on the previous slide. The left picture is supposed to be the picture for perspective warping. And then the picture on the right is the logarithmic perspective warping. So I guess here you can see how the two techniques compare. And logarithmic's better.
And these are all with the same shadow map size.
Yeah.
Right? And then I guess because the logarithmic requires two passes, it's hard to really go apples to apples.
It's hard to compare speed. So they lost one of my images. Well, you can see it here, actually. This is the logarithmic map. So it doesn't even, it doesn't look flat at all. It uses a logarithmic sort of transform. Yeah, back to the slides. So those were the perspective skewing techniques. And now I'm going to sort of a different way to approach the same problem. And these are cascaded shadow maps. So instead of using a single shadow map and warping it, this technique instead uses multiple shadow maps where they're actually the same sizes. So in the picture on the left, you see three different shadow maps representing the same light frustum, and they're the same resolution. But the one on the top is a much bigger shadow map, and less overall you would get less detail per area and space. And close to the eye, you have a lot of detail concentrated near the eye. And what you have to do is you simply rasterize the scene or parts of the scene three different times to create these three shadow maps. And then you render the world, and your fragment shader will choose which shadow map it should use based on how big the fragment is, essentially.
So I just want to expand on that for a second, right? So for vanilla shadow mapping, we have one, you know, one directional light source. We're rasterizing the entire, not the entire scene, but the entire scene from the perspective of that light a whole time up front just to build that shadow map, right? Now, the good news for that is, since it is a depth only, is you don't have to run any of your expensive shaders that are computing the color. A lot of times the bottleneck is going to be your fragment shader. It's going to have a whole lot of complications to come up with the color, and you don't have that. The other thing you're going to see on modern hardware when you're only writing the depth value is that you'll get double speed Z rendering, and that's been around since like a very old GeForce, GeForce 3 or something, a long time ago. But now Sean is presenting here cascaded shadow maps. Now, you got to render, in this example, you're going to render the scene three times per light that casts shadows, right? So this starts getting really expensive. And shadowing is like a huge deal, and hopefully, and I'm sure Eric will talk about it on Monday too, how his engine is set up to deal with shadows and handle them efficiently, because it can, because shadows drastically add to the realism of the scene, right? And they also help give good visual cues on where something needs to ground, but they can come in, you know, pretty significant.
Yeah, but it is worth it to do this.
Yeah, I mean, if you're making like a modern real-time rendering engine that's comparable to the other engines out there, like you have to do shadows and you have to deal with all the aliasing problems.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, your Sean's presentation here was like 3 minutes on how shadow volumes work, right, or shadow maps work, and then 1 hour on how you fix all the other problems that you don't realize are there.
Yeah. So you can visualize these different partitions of the frustum by the colors in the right image. So each color is essentially a different shadow map. The green one's going to be pretty high detail because it's the closest, followed by the blue, which is a little bit less detail, followed by the magenta, followed by whatever other colors are. And the yellow, which I think is the furthest, will be the least detail because we don't need that much detail because it's so far away. So one of the things we have to decide is how do we choose these partitions? How do we split the light frustum to make these separate shadow maps? And we can think about this from like different perspectives. What if you're looking from the bird's eye point of view? Then pretty much you see the whole scene and it's pretty much at the same depth away from you. So you might need only one or two cascades. But if you're like have a standard walking view, you're going to require multiple cascades. Like this would be, the picture on the right would be a typical like looking at the scene, walking through it, and you need multiple cascades. So sometimes artists determine how these are split. They look at the scene in the video game usually, and they say, okay, how do we split these so that it looks good? And then there's other ways. You could just do a uniform split, or you could do a logarithmic split, or you could do sort of a mix of the uniform and logarithmic, which can often produce less error overall. But it's better to have a dynamic approach. And so one thing that sample distribution shadow maps do is try to solve this, try to create a dynamic approach for splitting your frustum. What it does is it uses geometry information and occlusion tests to figure out what objects in the scene are actually visible, and then use that information to create more tightly bound frustum. It also tries to approximate the logarithmic splits. And then bringing this idea to the logical extreme is something pretty new, which is analyze the Z distribution of the samples from the camera's point of view, and then using a compute shader, trying to understand these, and then creating the best regions based on what was rasterized from the camera's point of view. So this picture here, on the left you see the standard cascade shadow maps. You see the blue? The blue shadow map is huge, and it takes up, there's so much empty space in it, which standard cascaded shadow maps don't really try to solve. So it's a waste of memory in a way. And then on the right, you see the sample distribution shadow maps. It can create these much tighter frusta. So the blue is now just covering the part of the scene that it needs to. So there's a lot of improvements that this gives. It just gives you overall more detail. I guess that's the most important part. You get more bang for your buck. Yeah. So those describe some ways to fix some of the aliasing from the point of view of shadow map resolution, aliasing with the perspective. And now we're going into a different topic, which is smoothing these hard shadows. These have their own aliasing issues.
So recall that we got soft shadows for free with photon mapping, or excuse me, pan tracing. And then we're going to see the tricks we have to play to get soft.
You have to do a lot of work to get soft shadows. So the first technique, which no one really uses, is linear filtering. And that's simply enable linear filtering on your shadow map texture. And then instead of just taking the closest pixel in the shadow map, you actually take a 2x2 region of pixels. And you interpolate between those. It's really simple to do. It has almost no performance hit because linear filtering is built into GPUs. Everyone uses it. But it's actually not that correct. So a better technique that came about in like 2004 or something like that is percentage closer filtering. And this actually acts pretty similar to the linear filtering, but it's slightly different. So it simulates these soft shadows. Also looking at the neighboring texels, it takes the four nearest samples in the shadow map using a GLSL command, texture gather. And then for each of these samples, it checks the surface depth with the sample, like doing the normal shadow map test. But on four samples instead of one, you can also do this with a texture gather call. Essentially what you have is, if you think about the light blue square, that's going to be sampling from four different areas in the shadow map. One of those areas is going to say, oh, I am in shadow, and the other three are saying, I'm in light. You just interpolate those results and your answer would be 0.75. It's different than linear filtering because linear filtering interpolated just the depth values, but this one's interpolating the results of the comparisons with a shadow. It's more physically accurate. And this creates sort of a soft shadow effect. To create a larger soft shadow, a larger penumbra, you can sample more pixels. So here is just four, but you can actually sample 16 if you want. Just sample each of the four, or sample each 2x2 region, so you have four different texture gather calls. And then you interpolate that.
Those. So why is it called percentage closer?
Because you're testing the percentage of samples that fail, or that are in shadow, compared to the current sample you're looking at.
Does everyone see that? I mean, it's a pretty simple technique. It looks at a neighborhood and says what percentage is in shadow, what percentage is not in shadow, and uses that to approximate the soft shadow.
Yep. And to improve this technique, you can use random neighbors. You can sample from random neighbors. One way to do this is use a non-uniform disk, like the disk up there, and then every frame just rotate this disk using just some texture that stores rotations. So they're not really random because you randomize them, put them in a texture, and then send them to the GPU, but it's good enough. And here you can see the difference. Actually, this monitor probably blurs it really well, so both sides look good, but the left side is blockier because you're doing just the simple algorithm from the previous page. But the one on the right creates nice, sort of noisy, but good-looking noisy, random-looking soft shadows. It also can do it in less texture reads overall, because it's just choosing random neighbors. So that's percentage closer filtering. And now another technique is variance shadow maps, which came around about 2 years after or so. The basic algorithm is store the depth in one map and store the depth squared in another. Then you can actually filter these maps to your liking. You can make mipmaps of them, you can blur these maps using Gaussian blur, which is what most people do. And then there's another technique that uses summed area tables, which I don't know if you guys talked about. And then using the values in the depth map and the depth squared map, you solve this probability function. Essentially what's going on is it tries to guess the shadow's strength. So if, for example, you're occluded by something that's very far away, it'll think, okay, this occluder very far away is going to make a very soft shadow. And so the strength is likely to be smaller. But if the occluder was closer, it would guess that the shadow strength would be stronger. This will become more clear on the next slide. Or maybe the next slide. So some of the advantages of variance shadow maps. They're able to capture large penumbra at a much smaller cost than the percentage closer filter.
Let's talk about the cost for a second. If you go back to the previous slide, Sean said that now we need two depth maps, right? One that stores depth and one that stores depth squared from the point of view of the light. The good news here is you don't have to rasterize the scene twice in this case because you can output multiple depth textures, which
yeah.
I assume is what they're doing.
Yes, they use a frame buffer, object.
So we talked about the fragment shader is able to have multiple outputs, right? And this is one good use case for now. You only rasterize once and you have two outputs, one is the depth and one is the depth squared. But this doesn't work, for example, for the cascaded shadow maps because you're rasterizing different parts of the scene in that case. So go on.
Yeah, and it also does a very good job of blurring the low-res shadow maps. The picture on the left is 21 by 21 blur filter, which is pretty big, but the shadow map is only 512 by 512, and actually it looks really good. It's pretty fast too, 141 FPS. And on the right, you can see a comparison graph. The orange parabolic looking curve is the percentage closer filtering that we looked at before, and as you can see, it gets pretty bad as you increase the filter width. As you make it blurrier and make the penumbra bigger, the performance really drops. Whereas variance shadow maps pretty much stay constant. You can make as soft shadows as you like, and it's the same as making a very hard shadow. So if you're aiming to have very soft shadows, variance shadow maps are the way to go. Also, this is a visual comparison. The top is shadow map. Next is the bilinear PCF, but bilinear, that's a little, you can do better than bilinear, so maybe it's not an honest comparison. And then the last is variance shadow map. And so this is the biggest problem with variance shadow maps. Like, no solution is perfect, unfortunately. You have this effect called light bleeding. This happens when essentially you have two occluders that are pretty far apart, and they shadow the same region. So as you can see at the, so for this image, there's a triangle that's actually not in the picture, that's slightly above the teapot. And at these lit edges you see, that like form the shape of a triangle on the ground, the probability function reads from the shadow map, which gives it the depth of the triangle because the triangle is closer to the light. So that's the value stored in the shadow map. And so it uses the depth of the triangle to make an estimate about the shadow strength. But it's actually a wrong estimate because it didn't realize that the teapot was also shattering that same area. The depth map can only store one sample per pixel. So there's no understanding that there's a second closer occluder, which is the teapot. It just thinks there's a triangle floating in space, and it thinks there's soft shadows around that, and it fails to recognize the teapot. So somehow it would be nice if we could sort of understand that for a single shadow map value that there might be multiple depths. So it would be nice to know maybe a depth distribution to know that, yes, there's a teapot and a triangle instead of just a triangle. So these are some of the solutions, and they're kind of math heavy. Actually, the first solution is pretty easy. It's not the best. It's kind of a cop-out, actually. you simply limit how light the shadow can be. So for the light that shows this triangle shape, you would simply darken it so that you didn't notice it as much. But this would actually have some problems. It would make your shadows much darker than you might want. And it would also make the fall off way too strong. Because if you darken everything, you're also darkening the nice fall off that's at the edges of the teapot shadow. So there's other ways to try to understand the depth. The first way doesn't try to do anything special. It's simply a clamping function. So one way is to represent discrete depth steps with smooth functions. So as you can see for the pictures, the depth kind of does this jump first. It's at the triangle, and then it's at the teapot. And we want to sort of approximate this like really strong falloff with a smooth function. There's two main ways to do this. One is convolution shadow maps. What that does is it approximates depth steps with a 1D Fourier expansion. I don't understand the math. And then the second way is an exponential shadow map, which uses an exponential function to approximate the step. And actually, I didn't put it on the slide, but there's a pretty simple formula for doing exponential shadow maps. And I think in practice, exponential shadow maps are more widely used and work better, generally. So that is pretty much everything. And now I'm just going to summarize sort of what the industry does in most of these cases. So if you're deciding between shadow volumes or shadow mapping, you should probably do shadow mapping if you're doing a video game. It's faster. It has a lot of aliasing, but it's faster, and that's actually more important.
Now, I will mention, too, the shadow volumes, they're not that easy to implement. I've implemented them and implement them robustly, you know, Sean, like you talked about the Z-fail. I mean, the Z-fail technique is just a start. There's a lot of things you have to do to get a robust shadow volume implementation, just like there is for shadow mapping, too. But
shadow mapping is generally easier, actually.
I can believe it based on my shadow volume experience.
Yeah, so go with shadow mapping. Which technique should you use to combat the perspective aliasing and the resolution issues? Well, we talked about warped perspective shadow maps or cascaded shadow maps. So warped was where it just used a skewing matrix, but used a single shadow map. And then cascaded shadow maps used multiple shadow maps to represent the same frustum.
Now, Sean, you also mentioned a hybrid where you're going
to
do a cascade.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to say that. Yeah, you can also apply the warped matrices to each of the cascades in the cascade shadow map. So some people do that. Most people find that's not necessary.
So what is, and I know that it can vary depending on the scene and the objects in the scene and where the viewer is, but for a cascade shadow map, I mean, how many cascades is common? Is two or three pretty typical?
I think, three, maybe four. Three, I think, is the most common.
And what's a common shadow map resolution that would be used?
1024 by 1024.
Even if the game is running at full 2 megapixel of 1920?
I think for at least, I don't know about like Xbox 360, but I think most people are doing 1024. Yeah?
Do you see weird artifacts at the edges of the shadow
map? Yes, you do. I didn't talk about that, but yeah, there are going to be problems because you're going from basically a very dense texture to a less dense texture, and you are going to see like pops along those lines. So one way that people solve it, probably the easier way, is to when you realize that you're close to these borders, you simply interpolate the values from both sides. That's the main way that people do it. Yeah, and also the thing about cascaded shadow maps, they're generally more stable. It's easier to do. Almost every AAA game right now uses cascaded shadow maps. I would go with those. And then, which soft shadow technique should you use? Well, percentage closer filtering might be good if you want hard shadows with a little bit of soft edges, because it's not too expensive when you simply look at like a 2x2 pixel region.
So what's a realistic kernel size or region that you're looking at? Like 2x2 with a 16x16 would be out of question, right? Like, what is common?
I don't know. Some people do 16 out of 16.
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
Because this is happening for every pixel, right? So if you do the 16 by 16 kernel, right, and that does the n, where n is 16 or 2 or whatever, that goes up with n squared, then that's per pixel, too. So it's a lot.
Yeah. Variance shadow maps are... I would probably recommend variance shadow maps because essentially you can blur your shadow maps with a Gaussian function. You don't have to do that for every pixel. You don't have to do it at the same time as you calculate the shadows. You can blur it and then read from the shadow maps. It does vary soft shadow as well.
And we're going to do a project. Your first GLSO project will be an image processing assignment that Sean had a whole week to do, but you guys will get 2 days. I've been threatening 6 hours, but now I've decided 2 days for you guys, and it'll get longer. And part of that will be doing simple Gaussian blur in screen space like Sean was talking about. So you can imagine that, although you'll blur colors, you'll take an image and make it blurry. But you can imagine the same technique could be your own depth values, where you render the depth, and then you do the Gaussian blur, and then you use it for the variance shadow maps to pressurize the scene again.
Yeah. And so we know that variance shadow maps have the problem of light bleeding. And I would say probably use exponential shadow maps, where you use an exponential function to try to have a better idea of the depth distribution. This area is really changing a lot. There seems to be a lot of new research in how to fix light bleeding. I'm not entirely sure about what games use, but they either just simply limit the threshold, like the first technique, the simple technique, or they use exponential shadow maps. I think convolution shadow maps are generally slower and produce some artifacts. And so what more can you do to make your shadows better? One way is just use ambient occlusion. It's a good way of just trying to get a feel for the basic global illumination of the scene. Ambient occlusion simply, it's as if you scatter rays and you see how close other objects are to you. And by that, you turn that into how shadowed it is or not. It's not really shadowing, it's just approximate global illumination.
You can think of it, and we will talk about ambient occlusion later in the semester, you can think of it as the shadow due to ambient light. So the more of a crevice you are, the darker you would be. So if you think of terrain, if you're on the top of the mountain, it would be very bright. If you're down the valley, it would be darker. And you will implement screen space and ambient occlusion. So you will have the depth buffer, and you may have normals as well, and you'll do analysis of the depths to approximate ambient occlusion in screen space. It's an assignment that Sean, you got out of last semester. I didn't get it in the last semester, but the semester before it was, we did it. And it was, I think at the time, it was considered the hardest. I think it was the hardest assignment that we had. Although for you guys, we just keep up with the class. It was going pretty easy. Although we're going to adjust the assignment there a bit, so I think it will be easier than what we did last year. But it's a very hot technique. You go into an interview at a game company or someone who's doing real-time rendering, and they're all about ambient occlusion, and in particular doing it in screen space as well. Because screen space has a lot of advantages as opposed to, say, pre-processing it, which is a whole lot of rendering stuff.
Yeah, talking about screen space, we can also use just our depth of field or motion blur, and these can help smooth some of the shadow artifacts. And yeah, just if you ever want to learn more about these topics, because there's a lot to learn, I actually took, the images that I took were basically all the sources I used. So if you just follow those links, you'll lead to a lot of different pages that teach you more. And I also referenced the following books, Real-Time Rendering and Real-Time Shadows. That's it.
So the real-time rendering, so no books in this course are required. The real-time rendering book is one book that I like, and if you're gonna buy one, it's a good book to have. And I did, on our schedule page on the website, put the relevant section on real-time rendering here, and just so you know, it's about 40 pages. You look at the next section, it's going to be nothing, but no, it's a full 40 pages. And those are, I would say that actually your talk here, Sean, is more comprehensive than the covers there, but the covers there are still very good. And the Real-Time Shadows book is recent. I think it was
published this year.
Yeah.
Or at least last year.
Yeah, last year or this year. I just got a copy of it a couple weeks ago. I haven't even opened it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. Okay, so I have some questions, and I'm sure everyone else has some questions too. But you talked about, okay, we can do motion blur and techniques like that to kind of make the artifacts less known. So in rendering, we do all sorts of things for anti-aliasing, period. Like, for example, I know some of the students did distributed ray tracing for anti-aliasing in their ray tracing, right? Where they shot 20 rays down and they jittered them.
Yeah.
Does any of the standard anti-aliasing techniques that we do as a post-process, do any of them help with the shadow artifacts that we see here?
So like multi-sampling?
Anything along those lines.
I think actually a lot of the shadow techniques are enhanced by multi-sampling. I know Baryon's shadow maps can use multi-sampling, but in general, using multi-sampling, it would help, yeah.
But it's not enough. Like, I can't just get away. Okay, I'm going to do vanilla shadow maps.
I mean, it's like, later. It's basically like increasing the size of your shadow map.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's not going to fix every problem. It won't fix the light bleeding, as one example.
Okay, so my next question is, what are your performance tips? So you picked your shadow mapping techniques, right? You picked all the different techniques you're going to use. But now, given knowledge of your game or your scene, what performance techniques do you recommend? So, for example, here's a couple to start with, right? Not all lights need to cast shadows, right? So you say in most games nowadays, only one of the lights might cast shadows, because then you're only going to render the depth maps for the one light source, right? The other thing is, not all objects need to cast shadows either, and this way you're going to draw less objects into your depth map. But what other techniques do you recommend performance-wise?
Like for basic or for the other techniques?
You can just answer the question however you want.
I feel like I talked about a lot of these, but I can't think of any.
So here's another one, is just general culling, right? So we have this view frustum, and we know that we only need to send the objects that are inside or that overlap the view frustum down the pipeline. Okay, now when you're doing shadow maps, now you're drawing from that perspective of the light. So you need to take, basically you need a computer volume based on the view frustum and a pyramid coming from the light, computer volume from that, then call against that volume as well. So there's lots of techniques like that, too, which I assume are widely implemented. I couldn't imagine any game not.
Yeah, shadow mapping is very tied to occlusion culling. You do your occlusion culling first, get the objects that are visible to the light, but also visible to your camera, and then those are the ones you use. So the two techniques are pretty much intermixed.
Okay, so my next question, you certainly showed us a lot of, you laid out the vanilla shadow mapping, which you said was 77 or 78, right? And then you showed all of these techniques and the visual quality better than over the past decade or past two decades. So what do you think the future holds for real-time shadows?
I wonder if it'll be ray tracing. I mean, that's like sort of far in the future. Like eventually, I would hope that sort of these shadow mapping techniques they're sort of like hacks. So, I mean, I don't know how far in the future we're looking, but ray tracing and path tracing don't have these same problems.
So do you feel with the addition of compute shaders, and we won't get to this later in the semester, but basically the rendering pipeline that I've shown you over the past few days, now you're able to stick in like arbitrary, it's a, really guess an OpenCL, but like think of arbitrary CUDA kernels in certain parts of that pipeline. And of course, when you write your own rasterization pipeline, you can do whatever you want. But do you think now with compute shaders that's more feasible, that we would do ray tracing for shadows?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, that's sort of what we're doing a little bit in our project, our independent study, but like using a compute shader, or at least using a fragment shader as a compute shader to do ray tracing. But also, as we saw with the sample distribution shadow maps, you can use compute shaders just to do normal shadow mapping, analyze the depth to build better fitted frustum.
So one thing that I want to point out here, so we went over the basic pipeline, and then Sean has jumped in to tell us about shadows, which I'm really happy about, because last semester I didn't cover shadows, and I know that we covered them in 460, but don't think that we cover them in the, I think that that was in the details, and that I don't think that, that you probably saw enough in 4.6 to really appreciate what's involved in fixing artifacts and getting the soul shadow. But, you know, so we see all that's involved in doing this, but now, so what's going to happen to the, and then we start talking about, oh, well, geez, there's geometry shaders and those compute shaders in this pipeline. It's getting really complicated, right? So what is the future of bowling? Is this pipeline just going to keep getting increasingly complicated until there's only three people in the world that understand the real-time rendering pipeline? And thankfully, my co-editor of Hope Joins Us would be one of those three. Or are new paradigms going to emerge as hardware trends continue to change, something like the ray tracers or the can tracers that you can have money? And that's why a big part of my motivation this semester is if there are big paradigm shifts, you guys are ready for them because you've implemented all these major rendering techniques down to the metal using CUDA in a parallel fashion. So that's kind of my goal. Maybe we won't know we won't know until years from now how effective this course was in that regard. But I'm hoping or predicting that it'll be very, very effective for you guys. Okay, enough of my questions. So what questions do you guys have about shadows? Okay, great, yeah, thanks a lot, Sean. Again, we'll see everyone on Monday in the David Rittenhouse lab across 33rd Street for Eric's guest lecture. Good luck on your restaurant.